You wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed,
you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation and a proud affiliate of the Alberta Podcast Network. We bring you community discourse about the amazing organizations and people who come together to make Edmonton strong. I'm your host, Elizabeth Bonkink.
And I'm Andrew Paul. Hey, Elizabeth, isn't today the day we announce the winner of our To K for Two contest?
That's right. Stay tuned to the end of the show and you'll find out who will win two VIP tickets to see George Takei at the Shaw Conference Center on November 29th. So let's get the show started.
On this month's episode, Connor Kerr connects us to Canada's Indigenous history with the blanket exercise, and we find out how to make our city a more welcoming place with Eric Ampman. But first, we speak with Omar Mualim and take a hard look at what it means to be Canadian both within our borders and beyond.
Omar Mualim is a journalist, editor, and award-winning writer. He's the co-author of Inside the Inferno, a firefighter's story of the brotherhood that saved Fort McMurray. He has written for several outstanding publications, including The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Wired, The Guardian, and BuzzFeed, to name a few.
He is also a contributor to our high-level lit anthology, which is a collection of stories that reflect on Canada's sesquicentennial through an Edmonton lens. The anthology was released on October 21st as part of LitFest in collaboration with 18 Bridges magazine. We'd also like to note that we recorded this interview on October 5th, just a few days after the terror attack in Edmonton on September 30th, 2017.
Without further ado, here's our conversation with Omar Mualim.
Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, Omar. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, well, we're really excited to have you on the show because you are a contributor to our high-level lit anthology, which came out on October 21st as part of LitFest. We would like to start by chatting with you about what people will find when they flip open the book and read your piece.
So this is a collaboration with 18 Bridges. There are 13 writers from Edmonton or sort of have a, let's say, a spiritual connection to the city of Edmonton who wrote poems, essays, or stories that reflect not just on the city, but also on this country, on the nationality of being a Canadian over the last 150 years for the, and I can never pronounce it correctly, the Sasquatch Centennial, I believe is how you pronounce it.
Yeah, we all meant what, you know? So the Sesquicentennial, I think, but that is a $5 word for sure. What is the piece that you contributed about?
The story that I wrote is a travelogue, but it's a travelogue in which I reflect on what it means to be a Canadian and personally what it means to be a Canadian whose parents came from another country. The assignment started because I was taking this 3.5-4 week trip that started in London and somehow ended in Kurdistan. Through this travelogue that goes from London to Salzburg, Austria, to Krakow, Poland, to Israel and the West Bank, to Kurdistan, I'm constantly sort of pondering, what is the definition of a Canadian? What does it mean to have a Canadian passport? What sort of cachet does it get you in certain countries that it doesn't in others? And in one particular country, in Israel, does it, for someone like me with my name, with my other dual citizenship that's Lebanese, is being Canadian enough? And so that's sort of what I reflected on throughout the piece.
So another theme that I found in your piece as well was sort of the idea of homeland and what that is. Can you tell us what, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, what balad means?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, we would hear about this place, the balad, all the time. And I mean, it's probably one of the first words that I learned, not just in Arabic, but any word. And I always thought that was the country that my parents came from, that they came from a country called the Balad. I didn't realize until they finally took me to Lebanon that Balad is actually, it's a colloquial term. It means homeland. The Balad can be Lebanon, but for me, it most certainly was not. It was Canada. So I started to think about like, okay, so if Canada is my homeland, why don't I have an attachment to it the way that my parents have to theirs? The way that they talk about their Balad is very romantically. It's this place that's very flawed. It's this place that frustrates them. It's this place that they left for a better life over here. It's this place that's more difficult. And yet it's this place that's culturally superior and that makes them wistful. And I tried to think about, well, what's my attachment to my homeland on Confederation Day this year? And, you know, I certainly felt some twinges of pride as a Canadian. I think that a lot of Western countries has sort of backslided into some pretty dark places these last few years. And Canada, for the most part, I think is holding up our democracy quite well. And that made me proud. But I certainly didn't feel the patriotism that I think my parents and a lot of immigrants feel toward their homeland.
So do you think that maybe that romanticism or nostalgia that your parents have for Lebanon, do you think that you have to move away from your homeland before you can start romanticizing it?
I think so. Either you have to leave it behind or it has to be withheld from you. So the last two stops of this trip in both Palestine or West Bank, for those who don't consider Palestine a state, and Kurdistan, I was in two regions of the world where the struggle for a homeland has been, for some of them, it was something that was taken away from them. And for others, it's something that has just constantly evaded. And that specifically, I mean, Kurdistan. I was there a month before the referendum that they just had late last September. And it was a very interesting time because everyone was talking about this referendum. Finally, the Kurdish people, after 100 years of intentional efforts to have their own sovereign state, might have it. But they also knew that this could come with a lot of repercussions, great instability. I mean, Kurdistan, the region, not just the region in Iraq, but the region itself overlaps with a lot of hostile states, Iran, Syria, Turkey, Iraq. So they know that they're taking a little bit of a gamble if they try to get this independence. And a lot of other countries, including the United States, have told them not to do it. And yet for them, this having statehood, having real borders around their region, and their flag being something that doesn't just fly in the region but will fly in the UN, that's something that they're willing to risk stability for that. So it was interesting to see the Kurdish people feel so passionate about this idea of a homeland. Whereas the Palestinian people were still fiercely seeking a state for themselves, whether it's the one state returning Israel to Palestine, and I know how unlikely that sounds, but there are still people who believe that that is the destiny, or two states and turning the West Bank and Gaza, but especially the West Bank, into the Palestinian state. But here, I mean, you know, no one's ever threatened my statehood, not legitimately, not realistically. And I've never left my homeland. It's never been taken away from me. So I really do think that to really appreciate it, it does have to be left behind or withheld.
So when you went to Palestine, you flew in to which airport was it again?
Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv.
In Tel Aviv.
Yeah, that was a trip.
Yeah, coming from a country that I don't want to say we take for granted necessarily as like a homeland, but that passport, that Canadian passport, I think we all take a little bit of comfort in the fact that it's a Canadian passport. This is solid. This is, you know.
I've literally heard immigrants tell me that the Canadian passport is the best passport in the world. And I was like, oh, yeah. Wow. How lucky am I? I learned that, that in some countries, at least in Israel, it doesn't matter too much. I got a hard time there. I knew that it was coming. People warned me, hey, you know, your name's Omar, you're Arab. They didn't even bring up the fact that my parents were from another country, though that obviously had a big place in it, too. You're probably going to get held up at the airport. So I was prepared for that. And sure enough, I did. I mean, I took my passport to passport control. The first question I am asked is, Omar Muallim, what is the origin of your name? And see, Muallim is a Hebrew name and an Arabic name. And he, I think, wanted to figure, he was a little bit confused, right? My first name's Arab, Islamic. My second name could be Hebrew. I told him that, you know, it's an Arab name. My parents are Lebanese. And he was like, Lebanese, kind of said it with this great suspicion. And then he sent me to this room where there was about a dozen other people waiting there. They weren't all just Arab. Some of them were African. Some of them were Caucasian, maybe from Chechnya or some of the Central Asian countries. But I started to notice a pattern when they were called up, when we were called up for an interview. It was Salam, Salah, Ali, Omar. They were all Islamic names. Some of the people there were women as well. And so I went through this process of being interviewed and re-interviewed and re-interviewed to make sure that I didn't have anything up my sleeve, I guess. Maybe to make sure that I understand that I'm under some scrutiny in this country. What they wanted to know was, you know, not just what am I doing here, but also where are my parents from? You know, where are they from? Where are they from in Lebanon? What's my dad's name? What's my grandpa's name? They made me write their names down twice. And they wanted to also know, do I consider Palestine a state? They wanted to know, have I ever written anything about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a journalist? And I mean, I would love to say that I was a defiant journalist and I said, that shouldn't matter. And, you know, freedom of expression and democracy. But it wasn't. I didn't do that. The truth is I wanted to get the hell out of there. I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could. And so this side of me came out that I'm not particularly proud of. And I just, you know, I was as friendly and as I could be. I sort of code switched to that patriot Canadian and really sort of distanced myself from my Arab roots as much as I could. And maybe more telling, when I was in that cubicle with the dozens of other, let's just say, Muslim-appearing people, I felt cold to them. I remember there was this woman who was sobbing. She was maybe my mom's age, and she was wearing this very dignified jewelry and a lot of makeup, and she was just sobbing. And I didn't do anything to comfort her. I didn't get her a cup of water. Nobody did anything, because I think when you're pushed to suspect yourself and suspect your own family in a situation like that, it's really difficult to even want to align yourself with a bunch of strangers, because who knows what they're here for and why make this situation any more difficult?
How did the discussions that you had about your heritage and nationalities in the Middle East compare to the discussions you're having with some of the people you're visiting in Western Europe?
Oh, it was so funny. In Western Europe, in London, I mean, it hardly even came up at all, right? I was at a pub with my old college roommate. He happened to be passing through London. I haven't seen him in 12 years. And some of his friends, and a couple of them were British. Some of them were Swiss. My college roommate was Mexican. And when they were talking to me, my parents' ethnicity, my other citizenship didn't even register. What they wanted to talk about was Justin Trudeau. They want to talk about how cool Canada is and like how, how relieved we must be that we don't have a Nutter Butters president or state leader in parliament. And, you know, it was funny that there was this shame over Brexit and this disgust over Trump, and it really made me start to feel like, yeah, maybe there is something to this Canadian moment. I mean, a lot of the reputation that we're having right now is a very tolerant country. Some of it's true, but I also think a lot of it is PR. But you talk to these internationals, and the way that they see Canada right now is like it is the shining example of Western democracy. And maybe the 150th anniversary of this country doesn't mean much for me, or maybe doesn't mean too much for other Canadians, but it does feel like, at least in the international world's view, we are having a bit of a moment, certainly.
So in your piece, you kind of say that the standards of excellence for...
It's true. I mean, that's what it is. That's what it comes down to, right? It's not anything that I think we need to pat ourselves on the back too much about, though I am proud of the way that this country has handled the refugee crisis, and I'd like to see them do more. But really what it comes down to is, in relation to what is happening in other countries, you know, the election of Donald Trump, the sudden swing to the right in the United Kingdom and Brexit, and the election of a very far right and some say, you know, neo-Nazi party in Germany, Canada's looking pretty good. And because of the decline in civility in these other countries, we're looking really good.
Yeah, but that's still being put to the test too, I think, particularly with the so-called terror attack that just happened in Edmonton. I believe it was on September 30th.
It's true. Canada has not been tested by Islamic terrorism the way that a lot of these other countries have been. We haven't had in Orlando, we haven't had a San Bernardino, a Nice, a Charlie Hebdo moment, and thank goodness we haven't. But this past week in Edmonton, we were tested a little bit. A man with a Islamic State flag in his car hit a police officer, repeatedly stabbed him, and then later rented a U-Haul or somehow obtained a U-Haul and drove over four pedestrians. And I think that it would have been easy for Edmontonians to hear that, see that, and slide into some of the responses that we've seen in other countries. And I don't want to condemn those people's emotions and say that they're wrong, but we certainly didn't give in to the panic that I think is even expected of cities and people when something like this happens. I'm very proud, actually, of the way that Edmontonians handled this. Obviously, there's a lot of anger, but the anger is directed for the most part toward one individual, which is how it should be in situations like this. It's not directed toward a whole people. Now, that's not to say that there hasn't been retaliation against Muslim people. In the last few days, I heard of at least two women, one who was harassed and one who was quite heinously assaulted. She had a glass bottle broken over her head on an LRT. She was a hijabi woman wearing a headscarf. I have the utmost faith in Edmontonians to condemn that and the Edmonton Police Service to charge and convict people who would do such things. But I am proud of the fact that we haven't, you know, it didn't just become this panicked police state during the manhunt for this, you know, I and other brown people and Muslim-looking people weren't being, you know, randomly questioned on the street when I think that happens in other cities, that happens in other countries when there's a terror attack.
Well, I think this is maybe a good time to leave off. And I just want to thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Andrew.
Thanks very much to Omar Mualim for sharing his reflections with us. The High Level Lit anthology features original work from 13 writers reflecting on Canada's 150th through an Edmonton lens. The anthology is free to the public, and if you'd like a copy, please follow the link on our website.
Connor Kerr is a consultant for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit education with Edmonton Public Schools. He and his colleague Kristen Miller came to Edmonton Community Foundation to guide our staff through a very impactful activity they call the Blanket Exercise. Connor joined me to talk about what the exercise is and why it leaves such a big impression on its participants.
Throughout the interview, you will hear excerpts from the passages that are shared during the Blanket Exercise. Let's take a listen.
Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, Connor. How's it going today?
Oh, it's going great. Thanks for having me here.
Maybe we'll just start by having you explain what the exercise is and what it entails.
It's basically an interactive history of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people in Canada from before contact with European groups to present day. And within the exercise itself, participants are able to go over lots of the different policies and things that have been put in government legislation, how it's affected the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. And you go over lots of different aspects, whether it comes down to, you know, the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit initiatives that are going on today, and also historical initiatives that were put in place to essentially marginalize First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people.
Now hear this. According to the Indian Act of 1876 and the British North America Act of 1867, you and all of your territories are now under the direct control of the Canadian federal government. You will now be placed on reserves. Also, you may not leave your reserve without a permit. You may not vote. You may not get together to talk about your rights. You may not practice your spirituality or your traditional forms of government. If you do any of these things, you may be put in jail.
One of the main focuses of the blanket exercise is to essentially give a different version of history that we necessarily didn't learn when we were going through school. It's told from the point of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples in Canada. You don't hear about this stuff when you're going through school unless you actively seek it out or if you got a really engaged teacher. So this is an opportunity to start presenting a different side to history and really appreciate our First Nations, Métis, and Inuit culture.
So what are some of the equipment and props that you use in these exercises?
For the props themselves, it can be done with just the blankets and the scripts. And the blankets themselves are intended to be the visual aspect of the land that we're on.
Blankets are spread across the floor. You are standing on the blankets, shoulder to shoulder with many other people. These blankets represent the northern part of Turtle Island, or what we know as Canada, before the arrival of Europeans.
And one of the really interesting things about the blanket exercise is it gives people the visual connection to the land and how the land is essentially being taken away over the course of colonization and 150 years of that within Canada.
You represent the Indigenous peoples, the people who have been here for at least 10,000 years. Turtle Island is your home and home to millions of people like you. You live in hundreds of nations, each with its own language, culture, traditions, laws, and governments.
When you came in, facilitated the exercise at Edmonton Community Foundation earlier this summer, it is such a visual and personal experience. So with the blankets on the floor and then watching those blankets be folded up into smaller and smaller territories, essentially, it's very affecting just to sort of see how the First Nations were divided and isolated. And there is so much emotion. It's a very highly charged experience.
You represent one of thousands of children who died at residential schools or who died later as a result of your experience.
You represent a child apprehended from your community during the 60s scoop. You were not able to reintegrate into your extended family and territory, leaving you with a sense of loss.
You represent members of the Papas Chase and Michelle bands who are pressured into surrendering your reserves. You are forced to give up your lands, your rights, your treaty status, and are converted to Canadian citizens. Your reserves no longer exist. Please step off the blanket.
Please step off the blanket.
What does reconciliation mean to you?
It's interesting because I've heard a good quote from a speaker once, and he said that reconciliation is like if I have a bike, you steal the bike, then you tell me I'm sorry that I stole your bike, but you don't give the bike back. Is essentially what's kind of happening with reconciliation right now. I'm a Métis and my family can trace their roots back to Edmonton. I was over visiting my grandmother who lives on the north side and she's a direct descendant of the Papa Chase First Nation that used to exist right here on Treaty 6 territory on the south side of Edmonton. And my grandmother had the family tree that my auntie spent years and years and years creating. You know, we had relatives that were arriving in Edmonton with the Métis Voyageur fur traders in the 1790s and then the Papa Chase relatives that existed here. And so reconciliation is, to myself personally, you know, this has been something that's really affected my family over the years. And I know with the Papa Chase First Nation being on Treaty 6 land in Edmonton and signatories to Treaty 6 and having that First Nation basically taken away from them, it's quite still profound and the effects aren't that long ago. Like within my family itself, my grandmother was raised by her grandmother and she heard all the stories of the Papa Chase First Nation. This is from a lady who lived right on that land. And I live in Hazeldean right now, and when I first got my house, my grandma came over, you know, and I were checking it out and looking around in the neighborhood, and my grandma kind of looks and she's like, this is good, because when they give us the land back, you can keep your house and they'll tear down all these other houses. And I was like, I don't know if that's necessarily going to happen, Grandma, but it's a funny step. And so I like to think of reconciliation in more of a terms of decolonizing a lot of our learnings and what we're doing. And when I mean decolonizing, I mean starting to think about the education systems that have been in place for a long time and even the way we perceive Indigenous government structures that were put in place by the Indian Act itself.
Is the blanket exercise sort of a one-time thing, or is this exercise something that's good to maybe bring back and refresh and keep those sort of feelings, you know, at the surface and maybe providing people more opportunity to talk about it? I think that maybe sometimes people don't have a space to talk about it openly. And that Sharing Circle did a very good job of doing that and providing that space.
The visual aspect is quite profound. One of the things that often comes from those sharing circles, is that how can we move forward from this? What is our next steps? And the reason I really personally like that is that it's the start of everyone's personal education, whether that's through their workplace environment, or whether they bring that home to the conversations they have around their table, around Indigenous issues, essentially, in Canada. Too often with these exercises, it's very much like, all right, we did the blanket exercise, now we're good, check mark, reconciliation achieved, check the box, let's get going. I think every single time you facilitate it, you take something different from it, whether it's you learn from the participants and their emotions or their responses to it, and you learn from their stories and their questions that happen within the sharing circle afterwards. And so I wouldn't say that it's necessarily something that needs to be a one and done thing. The thing with the blanket exercise is it really starts encouraging doing your own research within your own family and within your own community. I know quite a few people who, you know, they go online afterwards and they start actually looking into some of the aspects of what's happening within Edmonton. There's lots and lots of great Indigenous initiatives that are going on with lots of great organizations in the communities around Edmonton with Enoch and Paul Band and Alexander and the Moscouches communities down south and Saddle Lake. And they're all bringing their expertise and their knowledge in. And I think one of the good things about the blanket exercise is it starts looking at it from their perspective. For too long, there's been just this colonial approach to that. People weren't listening to people, Indigenous people within the community. They were moving over their voice. And this is a chance for Indigenous people to actually have their voice heard and their voice validated.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Many thanks to Connor Kerr for sharing his time with us. If you're curious about how to bring the blanket exercise to your organization, please visit our website for the link. We'll also have links to more information on the exercise itself and to the reconciliation recommendations set out by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada.
Each year, Edmonton Community Foundation partners with the Edmonton Social Planning Council to develop the Vital Signs Report. Vital Signs identifies community needs by providing the data about living in Edmonton. For example, did you know that 18% of Edmontonians said that they feel socially isolated from their community?
This year, our Vital Signs Report focused on belonging, a topic that the Edmonton Mennonite Center for Newcomers, or the EMCN, as we call it, is very familiar with. EMCN has been welcoming and integrating newcomers to our city since 1980 and helps up to 17,000 newcomers each year. Eric Amptman.
My name is Eric Amptman, the Executive Director of the Edmonton Mennonite Center for Newcomers.
Joins us to talk about his work with Vital Signs and EMCN.
Let's start out with, why is Vital Signs interesting or important to you?
It's both interesting and important to me. I think it's interesting because statistics paint a picture that supports a lot of anecdotal ideas and thoughts or things that we think we're seeing. It supports them and proves that they're true or not true. So in my position, I'm often advocating for newcomers and I'm saying, this is what's going on in the community. You know, kids are dropping out of school at alarming rates. People don't necessarily need to believe me, but when I have statistics to back me up, that's the evidence that allows programming to be developed and funds to be generated, because there's proof, not just the stories of Eric.
Of course, you are dealing with newcomers, which was identified as one of the categories in our Vital Signs topic this year that are at risk. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the things that you see?
Language tends to be one of the main barriers. There's cultural barriers, but language tends to be one of the big barriers to really being included in the broader communities. And within those groups, there are more vulnerable people. So women tend to have less access to language because of childcare needs, and there's only so many daycare spaces. Youth, particularly refugee youth who arrive in their teens, they really struggle to pick up the language, and most fail to graduate. So they're unlikely to graduate high school. So you've got a 19-year-old who doesn't speak the language well, doesn't have a high school education, and their prospects are quite low. So they tend to kind of fall through the gaps. And the last group is a bit of a surprise, which is seniors. A lot of seniors don't have the language. They often are motivated to learn the language because of their grandchildren. But when they learn the language, then they're able to make friends outside of their ethnocultural community or the community that speaks their language.
Are there a lot of seniors that are newcomers?
There are. You'd be really surprised how many newcomers come as seniors through family reunification or through a super visa because they're going to be the primary caregiver for their grandchildren. So they'll come, and they'll come often late, which means they have little to no language often. We support a couple hundred seniors in language programs, and we could double or triple it without exhausting our wait list.
So let's talk a little bit about what your organization does to foster more social inclusion and belonging for newcomers in general.
That's the whole purpose of our organization, is really to help people become Canadians, to enjoy all the perks that citizenship has with it. You know, being able to take advantage of everything that a city like Edmonton can offer. So we serve 17,000 people a year, and that's our mission.
So can you give us a couple examples, like language classes, daycare, what kind of things are happening?
Broadly, our organization is broken into three pillars. Language for about 1,000 people a day are in a language class somewhere through EMCN, somewhere in the city of Edmonton. Employment, so we do a series of employment, from helping people write a resume to actually finding them work as engineers or accountants. And then the last one is something that we call settlement, which isn't a very good description. It's helping people settle, which includes everything from helping someone fill out a form to register their children in school to providing mental health services for people who've been through a traumatic event, often torture and trauma in their home country.
Talk about a little bit about the diversity that you deal with.
Well, it is people from all over the world. I mean, recently it's come to light that there's a bit of a pipeline for Chechen, gay and lesbian folks to come to Canada as refugees. And so, yeah, we see people from all over the world. Myanmar, we'll see some Rohingya, I think, soon. People come to Canada from all over the world. We are easily the most welcoming country in the world in this current political environment. We are the only country that will allow you to claim refugee status based on your sexual orientation. You know, we've seen a lot of illegal border crossings across the country, and even in Edmonton, we're seeing people who are coming to Canada illegally because the situation in their home country is so dire that this is their last chance at hope.
So in the report, we talk about intersectionality. Are you finding a certain section of the population is having a harder time than others? I mean, you have your newcomer, but you also have your newcomer senior. You also have newcomers that may be disabled or have other issues.
It's an interesting question in that I think it's got a very complicated answer. There are, if you tick certain enough boxes, yes, you will be more isolated. So seniors, newcomers, don't speak the language, may only be connected with your family. And so that's the extent of your network. But it's hard to kind of paint people too much with those categories that they fall into because so many people are isolated. You know, I don't know my neighbor as well, right? And so what opportunities am I helping to create in my neighborhood? But yeah, I think it's a really complicated question. I think all of us benefit by making those connections. And so I think it's important that we collectively try to have impact to make this community a less isolated place for everybody.
I think too that you need to step out even though you're unsure, or we're, you know, often we'll say, I want to know more about the Indigenous culture, but I'm afraid to ask. So stepping out even more and laying that on the table and saying, look, I'm being honest here. I'd like to know, and having those conversations.
You know, do ask those questions. Do ask them from, know you're naive and you don't know the answer, but it's good to ask them. And people, I think, right now are really receptive to wanting to share. You've got a heritage and a culture, and I'm sure if I were to ask you about that, you'd be really excited to tell me about all the things that means to you. Like, I work for the Mennonite Center. I don't know a lot about Mennonites. I learned that they have something called a FASPA, which is like a charcuterie board, but it's like a lunch. So they just kind of take all of their leftovers and have a meal out of it. And so at my board retreat, that's what we did. I asked a couple of the Mennonite Bubbas to pull this FASPA together, and that exposed my board to an interesting piece of Mennonite culture.
What is one thing that Edmontonians maybe can do to help individuals feel more included?
I think like just saying hello to people is what I always advise others. When I first came to Edmonton, I'm originally from Winnipeg, and in Winnipeg, you like on public transit, you chat with whoever sits beside you. In Edmonton, that was like a big no-no. Like I really quickly learned that people will get up and like go somewhere else if you start trying to talk to them. So, you know, if you see somebody, you know, who looks like they're not from these parts, or even if you see somebody who is from these parts, I think it's a good idea to say hello. But, you know, making that effort to say hello and give them an opportunity to practice their English skills for 10 minutes, it's something that I think helps all of us feel included. Even in a meeting, if you know somebody isn't from Canada, after the meeting, you know, say hello, offer to take them, you know, we should connect over coffee, because they're wanting to build networks and don't have those opportunities. It's really just small gestures, I think, that go a very long way. And
you never know what friends you're going to make.
Yeah, you really don't. And you know, we can learn a lot from each other. As a city, if we're that type of city, we're all going to benefit.
I think that's great. And please come back and be on Vital Signs again.
I think if I wasn't invited, I would be devastated.
Thanks again to Eric Antman for joining us. If you'd like to check out the Edmonton Mennonite Center for Newcomers to see their resources or volunteer opportunities, we'll have a link up on our site.
And if you'd like to see more interesting facts about our city, be sure to check out our Vital Signs report. There are some great infographics and stats about newcomers, housing, arts and culture, sports, inclusion, and so much more.
You can find the report at ecfoundation.org or get the direct link from our site, thewellendowedpodcast.com.
And now it's time to show some podcast love, our latest segment where we will highlight one of our fellow members of the Alberta Podcast Network. This month, we're bringing in our producer, Lisa Pruden, to find out which show has caught her ear. Take it away, Lisa.
Thanks, Andrew. I've been tuning into That's So Maven On this podcast, host Andrea Bessa interviews female entrepreneurs and leaders. I love listening to how women navigate starting and leading their own initiatives. And I always feel empowered and inspired by these women who put themselves out there to build something that they love. So I highly recommend that podcast, That's So Maven. You can listen to it at yegmavens.com or download the CKUA radio app, where you can subscribe to all of the amazing shows on the Alberta Podcast Network. We'll have the link on our website.
We're nearing the end of our show, which means...
news time!
You bet. First up, we're quickly approaching the holiday season and the new year. This is a great time to talk about year-end giving, but don't take my word for it. Here's Noel Xavier, one of Edmonton Community Foundation's donor services advisor, to tell us five reasons why year-end giving is a good idea.
Thanks, Andrew. I've got my list right here, so let's dive right in. Number one, now's the time to give. This is a very important time to give. A lot of charities and causes start to see an influx of donations from their donors, but it's also a very busy time. So people might not remember to donate to their favorite charities. And of course, donating to a Canadian registered charity gets you a tax credit, which is also very good for your pocketbook. Number two, giving is a family activity. This is a great opportunity to engage family, especially young people, in the message about how important it is to help others. It's a great opportunity to introduce philanthropy into their lives and into your family's lives. Number three, the sooner the better. Remember to start early. Charities are not all open over the Christmas and holiday break, and some charities like Santa's Anonymous or the Christmas Bureau are especially busy at that time of year. So don't wait until the last minute to get your donation in. The deadline for receiving donations in 2017 is December the 31st. Number four, it's not all about the cash. There are many ways to make a charitable gift. While most people will make their donation via check or cash, a lot of people will take this opportunity at this time of year to make a gift of securities or mutual funds. That's a great opportunity for the donor because they don't have to pay tax on any capital gain. Instead of selling the stock and donating the cash, why not donate the stock directly to your charity of choice? Not all charities, however, have a mechanism for receiving securities or mutual funds, so please make sure that you talk to your charity of choice. Securities and mutual funds have to go through a few more steps. At the Edmonton Community Foundation, we actually recommend that all of our donors start their gifts of securities or mutual funds no later than December 1st so that we can ensure it gets in on time. Number five, talk to your charity of choice. The last thing that I think people should remember is that it's always important to talk to the charity about their intentions. If you've got a specific reason for your gift or you want your gift to go to a particular purpose, let the charity know what that is. It's also a great way to connect with the charity at this time of year. That's one of the things that Edmonton Community Foundation does really well. And for our donors, we always encourage them to share their stories with us, share what is most interesting to them about their charities of choice so that we can better find the fit.
Thanks, Noel. You only have until December 31st to make the most of your year-end giving. So if you're planning a gift, be sure to get in touch with our donor services team soon.
We always like to share our upcoming grant deadlines, so take a listen to see if you or someone you know might be eligible to apply for funding through Edmonton Community Foundation.
Community grants are for registered charities in the Greater Edmonton area and can be up to $40,000. Applications are due December 1st.
And the intake for Vital Signs grants is now open. These grants support projects and programs that address the needs identified in Edmonton Community Foundation's Vital Signs report. Applicants can apply for up to $10,000, and the deadline to apply is January 15th.
All right, it's time to announce our contest winner. Andrew, do you have the names of everyone who entered?
I've got them all here in a bowl, and we're going to do the draw. Can we get a drum roll? And the winner of our Takei for Two contest for two VIP tickets to see George Takei live at the Shaw Conference Center November 29th is Gail Jones.
Congratulations, Gail Jones. We'll be in touch with you soon to get your tickets. And that brings us to the end of the November edition of the Well Endowed podcast. Thanks to each of our guests for sharing their time with us.
And thanks to our listeners for spending some time with us as well. We hope you enjoyed the show.
And if you did, please be sure to share the episode with your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. We've been your hosts, Elizabeth Bonking
and Andrew Paul. Until next time.
The Well Endowed podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation
and is an affiliate member of the Alberta Podcast Network.
The show is edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at the ECF.
Our theme music is by Octavo Productions.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Well Endowed.